This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation about what happened yesterday in Connecticut in the primaries on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. As a matter of fact, today you can find us on Facebook Live. We're broadcasting live to the world as we were last night. You can always call us at 860-275-7266. You can give us some of your impressions about what happened at the polls yesterday. And I want to welcome back in Colin McEnroe. He's host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Good to see you once again, just a few hours after I last saw you, Colin.
Fresh as a daisy.
Fresh as a daisy. And also welcome back to Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
Good morning, John.
And welcome to Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Susan.
Good morning.
So a lot of stories to follow. Let's start with the governor's race, and let's start on the Democratic side. Let's hear from the guy who won really, really big last night, Ned Lamont.
I just got off the phone with Mayor Ganim. He could not have been more gracious. I said, you had a pretty feisty campaign. He said, so did you, Lamont. And we're going to be working together. We get together tomorrow. Our party is united. We're focused. We know what we got to do. We're going forward, and we're going to win.
And he did win big last night. That was not so much of a surprise. Perhaps a surprise was on the Republican side. Bob Stefanowski, the businessman who he said he didn't vote for quite a long time, and he didn't go through the regular primary process, and he fairly handily won the Republican nomination. Let's listen to what Bob Stefanowski had to say.
I learned that to save our state, we have to defend core Republican values of smaller government with less interference in our lives, lower taxes, greater personal responsibility, and the highest moral and ethical standards possible.
Well, let's start right there, Colin. So, Bob Stefanowski, a surprise to you?
Well, I think anything was going to be a surprise. I mean, there really wasn't a clear front runner. It was this kind of Cheesecake Factory menu of choices, and you sort of tried to combine. I think the voters sort of tried to figure out what combination of qualities would work for them. You know, there was a very hard-fought and at times kind of toxic campaign. The back and forth between some of these candidates, maybe especially Stefanowski and David Stemmerman, really got pretty hot at times. And, John, we do have one extra piece of tape here. This, and it's a little bit of an invasion of privacy. Wolfie, I think we have a tape of David Stemmerman talking to his family after the results last night.
Look, everybody, I'm not wrong often, but when I am, I admit it. I mean it. I would like you all to accept my apology.
Well, what about Bob?
What about Bob?
Yeah, Dad. Don't you think you should apologize to Bob?
I will not apologize to Bob.
Why not?
All right. I'll apologize to Bob.
So that's the beginning of healing, anyway.
How did you get that tape?
I can't talk about it. But on a serious note, I do think that as they looked at that Cheesecake Factory menu, what they really saw probably that helped Stefanowski was a combination of three things. Total outsider, guy who rejected the convention process and really kind of rejected the whole Republican apparatus to the extent that there is one. Then he's the business guy, but there's two other business guys to pick from. And then I think the thing that differentiated him from those two other business guys was anger. He plays anger. And I think there's a lot of anger out there, particularly probably on the Republican front. But in general, people aren't happy with the condition of the state right now. So he's got an emotional core to his campaign that's, I think, a little bit different from, say, Stemmerman or Obsitnik, two businessmen who didn't run that way.
Paz, what do you think? Are we surprised about Bob Stefanowski coming out of this? Because I think, you know, I've told a couple people already this morning, you could have put four of the five names in a hat and picked out a winner. And I suppose the what happened last night surprised me just in the strength of Bob Stefanowski's turnout and how handily he won.
Yes. There are campaign operatives who did share the latest sort of tracking polling with me. And what it showed at the end was that Stefanowski, despite being battered by the rest of the field, still seemed to be the front runner, even at the end, with a big caveat. And that caveat was, you know, there was a big undecided vote. Boughton was still in the mix. And then the question was between Stemmerman and Herbst, would one of them find enough votes? And Herbst was the one who had the clearest strategy there. He tacked hard to the right. I think he certainly demonstrated that the death penalty, even in a Republican primary, does not move lots of people. He had the endorsement of the state's biggest gun group. That didn't do it. And he had the backing of the Family Institute of Connecticut. And they, their leader brutally attacked Bob Stefanowski as a fake conservative. And none of that took. So I think to Colin's point, the bulk of the Republican electorate, they were looking for an outsider. They were looking for somebody with a business message. If you had to look at the difference between Stefanowski and Stemmerman, Stefanowski from day one showed he had a good organization. He had a good plan. He had sufficient funds. He did not have the $6.2 million that David Stemmerman had, but he certainly had enough. He had more than the publicly financed candidates. And he had a message that, you know, people would roll their eyes. I'm going to get rid of the income tax. But all he talked about was taxes are too high. Taxes are too high. We need a business guy. And he, you know, he's stuck with that.
I actually was talking with Jonathan Wharton, our analyst from SCSU last night, Susan, about this. And he's a Republican. And, you know, we started talking about this idea that a lot of Republican voters in the post-Trump era, if someone says, I'm going to get rid of the income tax, they don't take him literally. They don't take him seriously. Mm-hmm. They know that what he's saying is, I'm going to try to get rid of the income tax, and that's where I tack. Right. And I think that us trying to hold a Bob Stefanowski's feet to the fire of I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that doesn't necessarily resonate with a bunch of voters who just want to hear somebody say that's the thing I'm going to try to do.
Right. And again, that's that emotional appeal. That's that emotional core. I think that there is sort of a post-truth thing going on here where people want to they want something that emotionally resonates with them. They want somebody who feels that same kind of anger. I actually was a bit surprised that he did as well as he did. I was watching the returns come in, and all over the state, outside of the sort of Boughton area in the West, he did really, really well. Like all the small towns, he won. Like he actually was coming close to a majority, which is remarkable. So getting in early, getting on advertising, and you know, just being consistent, it really, really seemed to help him.
I want to actually play a piece of tape from Mark Boughton. He was, of course, the endorsed candidate going in. He's been through this process several times. The mayor of Danbury, here's what he had to say about the type of campaign that won last night.
I do think there's something to be said about this sort of new style of campaigning where things like conventions and the grassroots really doesn't matter. You got to get up on TV early. You can pretty much bypass or short-circuit the, you know, that process, go get signatures, and be the nominee. And I always kind of thought that, but this sort of confirms that tonight.
That's audio from WTNH Channel 8, Colin. Mark Boughton saying, well, maybe this is the way it works now for Republicans.
Well, I mean, it certainly shows the disadvantages of the citizens' election program. There are many advantages to the citizens' election program. It's one of the primary reasons we had so many candidates overall last night is because if you want to run for one of these offices, you can go get a grant. Although I would like to point out, a little side like Kurt Miller, who ran for comptroller last night and appears to have won, he never got his grant. He actually never qualified for the money. But in general, it works really well for people. But you do have to wait. And of course, Sitnik got stuck in the pipeline and it stalled his campaign and, you know, really, really hurt him a lot. Stefanowski and Stemmerman, they didn't have to wait. They got on the air. They introduced themselves very quickly to the public. Now, they both did that, and Stefanowski ran quite a bit better than Stemmerman. So obviously there are some other factors that kick in.
Well, yeah, one of the factors is I think he had, he had a better team. He had a better plan. It was evident even in his petition drive. Those petitions came in pristine. People at the Secretary of State's office said the rejection rate was incredibly small. So I think from day one, he had a team that knew what they were doing. They knew what they wanted to do. And they had a game plan and stuck to it. Now, the big question with Stefanowski going forward, we're still making
it'll
that
be
mistake.
Easier now.
It'll
Don't
be
worry.
Easier.
Yes.
It'll be thank God for that. But is money. Now, he did not have Stemmerman money. He did not have Ned Lamont money. He had, $2.5 million, $2.6 million. But he also had a super PAC that was dedicated to him, as we see in presidential races. And, you know, this sort of blew up at the end, and they threw in another $1.2 million. And this is going to, I think this is the other lesson here. There, three of the five candidates, including two who are publicly financed, had dedicated super PACs. Now, neither of the other two could compete with Stefanowski's. But, you know, Stefanowski's super PAC, it's a short list of donors, but it's interesting. There's one guy from Greenwich who put in $730,000. And then there is a mega donor from the Midwest. He only put in $100,000, but he's an interesting guy to watch because he's a guy who spends millions in backing conservatives in governor's races and congressional races.
I just want to point out, there's something – I don't know if the word is comical, Susan. I understand that this is the way the political system works right now in America. But if indeed the message is – Hartford's taking our money. We're being taxed too much. I'm going to cut out all the waste of state government. I'm going to make sure that your dollars aren't going down a toilet in Hartford. But in order to get that message through, someone's willing to spend $730,000 in order to get you to be the purveyor of that message. That tells me, I don't know, a little something.
Yeah. Which extremely rich man would we like to have be our governor? Which person with all kinds of money coming in from all kinds of places that we want to be. There's, yeah, I mean, what interests are behind all of this? People, you know, are is it going to be like these sort of dark money PACs coming out again that we don't know where the money's coming from? I don't think Stefanowski's going to have a problem with money. I think he's going to raise plenty now that he's a nominee. But yeah, it's not comical, I think, so much as kind of depressing.
Well, I'm not sure
he'll be able to directly raise the money. If you look at, you know, he only raised like $500,000 directly, and he put in his own money, and 70% of the party voted against him. And he doesn't seem to be tapped into that world where you can get enough people who can write checks for $3,500 as opposed to knowing a small number of people who can write checks for $100,000, $450,000, and so on.
Well, let's just turn quickly from the money, though, to the numbers on this, because I think one of the things that I'll ask you first about, Susan, I'd love to hear Colin and Paz on this, too, is, you know, because this was a five-way race, Bob Stefanowski, he ran very well. He ran a good campaign. But again, the total numbers of votes that he captured last night might not be the total number of people that he needs to get enthusiastic if he's going to beat Ned Lamont in November.
Right. I mean, we do have to remember that this was something that he won with 30% of the vote. And fewer Republicans turned out than Ned Lamont had voters. So it's a small, 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 tiny slice of the electorate. Right now, people are waking up thinking, Bob Stefanowski, who is that again? They have no idea who he is if you're not tapped into Republican primary politics right now. And that makes it kind of dangerous for him.
Is that the biggest hill to climb, the fact that Ned Lamont, Colin, had more votes than voted for all the Republicans in the field?
They both have the same hill to climb. So Bob Stefanowski got 41,000 votes last night. To win a general election, he would need more than 500,000 votes. So he's got to wave a magic wand over that 41,000 and turn it into a lot more. He's got to do that by, first of all, consolidating the Republican Party. As Paz said, 70% of them voted against him. I'm assuming most of them come running back to the fold. And then he's got to go out and get those unaffiliated voters who are this huge bulk. And I mean, I think we kind of do know pretty much how he's going to run and what he's going to run as a Republican now, you know, and but also as an outsider and also as a guy whose dissatisfaction bordering on anger with the system either does or doesn't mirror the electorates. My guess is that, I mean, Lamont has, you know, a not terribly different problem. I think he got 170,000 votes last night, which is a lot more and it's a lot closer to going over 500,000. He's going to have to run some kind of campaign, though, that attracts those unaffiliated voters. And if I were him, instead of meeting with Ganim today, I'd try to make a squash date with David Stemmerman. I try to find some kind of Republican or a few Republicans who might be willing to talk about him favorably, be in a commercial with him, because the other thing people are tired of is partisanship. And Ned, because he's kind of an affable, go-along, get-along kind of guy, I think he can run as a uniter. I don't know if that's his plan, but if I were him, I'd run as a uniter, not a super partisan guy, a guy who, you know, look, here's a couple of Republicans who think he's pretty good. But he has to have a message that appeals also to this huge bulk of unaffiliated voters.
Did you have a quick thing, Susan?
Yeah, I feel like that Republicans last night kind of nominated the generic Republican in a lot of ways, that this is as close to generic Republican as we can kind of get. And I do think that the Republican Party is going to be behind him. But he also does have that same advantage of not being a partisan. I mean, he was a Democrat until fairly recently. He didn't even bother to vote in 2016, so he doesn't have to explain anything there. So I don't know. I think that actually kind of helps him.
Well, he was kind of Democrat curious, right? He kind of went on a he went on a Democrat bender.
But yeah, nine months.
9 months.
9 months.
Right.
He woke up and went, "Whoa,
what was I doing?"
Well, but you know that hurt him in the or should have hurt him in the primary. And if it didn't, well, that's not going to be a good issue for Ned to say. This guy, he was a Democrat.
Yeah.
Well, I maybe you say generic Republican. I'll say generic Republican circa 2018. I don't know if that's the generic Republican that maybe we all grew up with. Very quickly, before we change topics, Paz. So, Ned Lamont, we spent a lot of time on this show. We did think pieces. You went out on the road with Joe Ghanem. 16%? I mean, Joe Ghanem didn't get very much traction. We didn't expect he'd get very much traction, certainly outside the cities. But the cities didn't turn out. No one was enthusiastic about Joe Ghanem. Should we flip this on our head and say people were enthusiastic about Ned Lamont?
They were either enthusiastic about Ned Lamont or they were enthusiastic about delivering the message that they did not want their party's nominee to be somebody who served 7 years in prison for systematically shaking down contractors in the city of Bridgeport.
People get enthusiastic about that in Connecticut? That's interesting.
I met some of them, and yes. And I believe the final results were the only place Joe Ghanem won was the city of Bridgeport.
I know. I'm losing a dollar to Curry on that.
Yeah.
That is really remarkable. Anything else that we can take away from Ned Lamont's very decisive victory yesterday, Colin?
I don't think there is stuff that you can take away. A lot of it depends on what he does with this. I mean, 170,000 votes, that's pretty good in a way. The turnout was a little stronger than we had thought during the day on both sides. People did get kind of curious or interested in this election or in this primary as it rolled towards a vote. And I think a lot of it, like, how does he consolidate that and how does he begin to build a bridge to the unaffiliated? It's going to be the story of his campaign. And, but, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And there was one point I think we should make before we move on. You know, Stefanowski showed you don't need the party. You don't need the convention. Conversely, with the exception of Stefanowski, it was a big night for endorsed candidates. Mm-hmm. You know, Johanna Hayes, yeah, she won, but she was sort of semi-endorsed with the backing of Chris Murphy, and she almost had the endorsement. So if you look at everything but governor, it was good to be the endorsed candidate. And oh, by the way, apparently you must be 40 years old or older to be nominated by the Republicans because the 30-somethings, and there were a bunch of them, they could have had a really interesting millennial, semi-millennial ticket and, you know, it didn't go.
Yeah. What was I going to say? Never mind. Yeah, I'm sorry. It was too late of a night last night. I was going to say something about the conventions. Nope, it's gone.
I'll tell you what. We'll move on past the conventions.
We've already
forgot about the party conventions. Thank God for that. Susan Bigelow is here from CTNewsJunkie.com. Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. When we come back,
I'll never forget my Absitnik moment.
I know he had quite the Absitnik moment. Danny Haar, I think, is still having his Absitnik moment this morning. We're going to turn our attention to Johanna Hayes and the 5th District race for Congress. Something very interesting happened last night. A big national story, and we'll talk about that in the Wheelhouse here on Connecticut Public Radio. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. It's the day after primary day, and we're talking about the news of the week with Susan Bigelow. She's a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Mark Pazniokas is here. He's Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, which is ctmirror.org. And Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. What's on your show today, Colin?
Well, it was decided today to give me a break at 1 o'clock. We have a show about the work of Hannah Arendt that we thought spoke pretty well to this past weekend's conversation about white nationalism, white power, stuff like that. So we're going to run that, and I'm going to go take a nap or something.
Yeah, it's been sort of a long day for Colin McEnroe over the course of the last several hours. So Colin McEnroe coming up at 1 o'clock on tape this afternoon. Let's listen a little bit to a new rising star in the Democratic Party, Johanna Hayes.
Tonight is just the beginning of the real fight. The fight for the soul of this nation.
Johanna Hayes takes advantage of the fact that Well, when the person who held that seat decided she was going to step down, Elizabeth Esty, it opened up a field. And as we just said, Susan, not too many minutes ago, Johanna Hayes was not the endorsed candidate. Mary Glassman was the endorsed candidate. Mary Glassman is someone who's been part of these statewide elections before. But Hayes did have the endorsement of Chris Murphy. She also had that, you know, little piece of tape where she was up on stage with Barack Obama getting the National Teacher of the Year Award. And those sort of things matter a little bit. So talk about Johanna Hayes this morning and what we should make of this person who it seems now has a pretty clear path to getting into Congress.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out that she didn't lose the convention by much. She just barely lost, and she had all of the enthusiasm in that convention space that she has a lot of very enthusiastic backers who wanted to see somebody new, who thought that her being the Teacher of the Year in this kind of environment was really important, who wanted to send a black woman to Congress, especially for all of the people in Waterbury and New Britain and in the cities who really wanted to have someone like them, someone who understood them, actually go to Congress. And that seemed like that was something that was fairly out of reach until this year. So that kind of opportunity for that kind of a change, it really, really fired people up. And she won a very, very large victory.
And as we hear her talking about their paths from her victory speech last night, she's going to go to November, and she's potentially going to go to Congress as someone who will, you know, make an awful lot of people look at what she's saying, and she's going to fight against Donald Trump and the Republicans that are there in Washington. That's a message she's already starting to send.
She will arrive in Washington with the advantages of being, you know, and I don't mean this in a demeaning way, but the it girl, you know, the candidate of the moment. The media always looks for people who embody, you know, the zeitgeist of the moment. You know, in New York, it's going to be Ocasio-Cortez. But she will have that opportunity. So what comes with that can be a pretty bright spotlight. There's opportunity in that, and there's risk in that. But, you know, she already has sort of been through the fire as Teacher of the Year, which normally is not something that is politically difficult. But when she was selected in 2016, there was some suggestions that because there had been very few black teachers of the year, that she was chosen because of race. So she's had this conversation before. She's had these conversations across the country in many different places. She's comfortable with that discussion. So, I mean, she will be an interesting person to look at. And, you know, she is in a district that, interestingly, the only other black member of Congress from Connecticut, it was elected from that district. Now, he was a Republican. There was some crossover appeal there. But, you know, she is certainly looking at a very discouraged Republican Party in the general election. I covered in the same room in Torrington, I covered a Republican debate for Congress and the Democratic one. The Democratic one, you know, the fire marshal basically had to shut the doors because it was packed. There's a lot of interest. And the Republican one, there was hardly anybody there other than friends and family.
I think she's a rock star. Having said that, and I'll come back to that in just a second. But having said that, you know, it's important not to get too far out over our skis. She got 24,000 votes last night. She's going to need, I mean, midterm congressional elections have lower turnout than general, than presidential year elections for Congress. So she, you know, she could win with 100,000 votes or so. She seems to have all the tools that are necessary to win, although in that seat has been closely contested, more closely contested anyway than any other congressional seat. And even Esty's last two cycles, I mean, she won. She didn't win by these huge dispositive margins that the other candidates do around here. I think, you know, that Johanna Hayes brings together three or four terrific tools. One of them is, I mean, her bio is tremendous. I mean, it really is a story of overcoming every possible disadvantage. I mean, she's been hitting off the back tees her entire life, and she's been hitting holes in one. That's just a great story. She also just has an incredibly winning personality. She's got a million-dollar smile. She's just great on television. MSNBC is already wild about her. Those things don't hurt. I think she's a little different from Ocasio-Cortez in a couple of different ways. One of them is that Ocasio-Cortez is from a different kind of district, right? This is – the 5th District is a very, very tippy district compared to where a pretty obviously solidly Democratic district like that one in New York. And she's not, you know, as everybody has just said here, she's not some kind of insurgent candidate. She's the hand-picked choice of Chris Murphy, the most powerful politician in the state of Connecticut, who made his operatives available to her. This is not some, you know, somebody kind of charging in from the left. She's going to have a lot of positions that are similar to an Ocasio-Cortez, but she's not an anti-machine candidate. She's very much a product, a necessary product. And just to say one more thing, just to remind everybody of what Paz and Susan said, this is the first Black Democratic nominee for Congress or for the Senate. We've never had a Kamala Harris, a Barack Obama, a Cory Booker, a Maxine Waters. We just have never had that, which is kind of weird in a blue state with some significant urban voting areas. It's just weird that it has taken this long.
But it's perhaps not weird if we go back to something we were just saying, Paz, that the Democratic line, once again, for the most part, fairly held steady. The people who were expected to win mostly were expected to win, and those people were, you know, mostly across the board party endorsed, and that meant it's white people that we've seen for a long time. Again, with some exceptions, you know, Sean Wooden going ahead in the treasurer's race, that's a position that has been held by African Americans in the past. William Tong doing well, certainly for attorney general, that's something that's a little bit new, but the Democratic Party in Connecticut seems to like to have things sort of be the way that they always are, and that has kept people from, like Johanna Hayes, from getting a shot.
Yes, and also it speaks to the paths that people generally take. Now, she was different. You know, she came from the outside, yes, with the support and encouragement of Chris Murphy and his staff. But typically, the people who run for Congress had come from the General Assembly. I mean, there are exceptions. Rosa DeLauro was a staffer who had never held public office. Jim Himes, you know, was sort of a local guy down in Greenwich, and he popped up. But typically, you have people from the General Assembly. They climb the ladder. You know, Chris Murphy is the best example of that. You know, State House, State Senate, U.S. House, U.S. Senate.
How many more rungs are there on this ladder?
Hmm. but to your point, you know, it is Connecticut. You know, the first district is and thirds are the districts that are most amenable politically to minority candidates. The fifth is not. So it's interesting. She is a crossover candidate. Now, you know, it's always tricky to talk about race, but, you know, I'm going to go there. If you're going to have a Black candidate in that district, having somebody who is A, a woman, B, who is a teacher, teachers are accessible. Teachers are not threatening. You know, Gary Winfield of New Haven, African-American state senator who loves to lift weights, and he always tells me about how he cannot have the luxury of ever exhibiting anger in public as a muscular Black man. That's just reality. You know, that's part of our world. So Johanna Hayes does have, call it crossover appeal. Again, she's a mother. She's got a great story. You know, she's married to a cop. They live in a world that is accessible, I think, to the average voter and understandable.
But I've said this before on the program, Susan, though. I think, you know, maybe being a public school teacher and not just the National Teacher of the Year, but just being a public school teacher working certainly in an urban district, I don't know if that prepares you as well for Congress as anything else, but it certainly seems like a pretty good thing to put on your resume. You understand firsthand about education, about urban issues, about poverty, about race. You understand what parents actually care about because they show up at school and they're complaining to you about the things that matter in their lives. You hear that every single day, and a whole lot of people are sitting in lawyers' offices or maybe trying to climb the ladder to get into the state legislature. They don't hear that ever.
No, they don't. And I've been a teacher. I was a public school teacher for a little while. I did not teach in an urban district, but I have to imagine that teaching in Waterbury is actually way harder than running for Congress. So Yeah.
I think that we can all endorse that.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely. This is a breeze compared to that. Teaching is a very, very demanding profession. But yes, people know teachers. And I think that there's a lot of Democrats who are interested in sending a message to like the Betsy DeVosses of the world who are making a charge against public schools and the Trump administration. I think that's a part of her appeal. And I do think that the fact that she has been dealing with all of these things, these overwhelming things as a public school teacher, it also just adds to things.
And the one cautionary note I'll add is she's going to have some hiccups along the way. And there was a moment in the debate in Torrington, and it was an audience question. And it was about basically where do you stand in support of the state of Israel? And Hayes sort of stumbled and said, oh, that's complicated. And, you know, they went to Glassman, and Glassman gave the conventional answer, which was very succinct. I stand with the rest of the Connecticut delegation in support of the state of Israel. And Hayes wasn't ready for that moment, you know, and it just showed that she was new to it. Doesn't mean that she won't develop an opinion, but she could have other moments like that. Now, happily for her, it does not appear that the Republicans are going to invest more than 10 cents into this race. I think the DCCC, the Democratic National Group that supports their candidates, are going to make sure she's got the dough. Teachers unions will as well, but I do not see the National Republican Congressional Committee spending 10 minutes looking at this race.
One would hope that someday a candidate will say something like, I don't think the conventional paradigm of our approach to the Middle East works at all. It hasn't worked for 60 years. Maybe I don't stand with the delegation. Maybe I'm looking for new ways to put other things on the table.
But she didn't have that opinion.
No, she didn't do that.
She's not there yet.
Yeah, she's not there yet. She seems like a pretty quick study. She'll get there. But it's important. I think what we're all saying the same thing in a way, which is also in the 5th District, you can't just run as – there aren't enough Democrats there for you to just run as a really kind of conventional skewing left Democrat. She is going to have to find aspects of her message that work for people who just don't identify that way. I think it's not just that she was a teacher too. She's had to deal with the government her entire life. What the problems are with public housing? Well, look, she's lived in a lot of public housing. You know, you want to know problems with drug treatment? She's had to deal with that in her family. You know, there's like all these things that we talk about as governmental abstractions, which are lived realities for her. That's going to help her a lot with some voters. Other voters are going to have to hear a different story and a different set of messages, because you don't win in that district with a just straight out left wing message.
I'll be interested to see to what extent she campaigns outside that district on behalf of the statewide ticket, because she is somebody that people are excited about. And she can help. She can help outside of the 5th District for a party that went through sort of a kind of ugly family discussion about Lamont's inability to recruit a minority running mate.
Well, let's just talk about that quickly. And we'd mentioned Ava Bermudez-Zimmerman very, very briefly. This is another potentially insurgent candidate, more, Susan, of the type of typical insurgent we might see. This is someone running to the left of a very establishment politician, Susan Bisewitz. We weren't quite sure how Ava was going to play yesterday. About 40% of the vote, which didn't allow her to win, but is seen by many as a sign of progress for progressives.
Yeah, it's a little bit of progress. She had a lot of excitement behind her and a lot of interest, but she didn't really have the sort of campaign experience. She didn't have, I don't think she had the best people around her necessarily. But she does send a message. And she does, she and Johanna Hayes both send the same message, is that people want the Democratic Party to be more diverse in its candidate selections. And this is something that a large number of Democrats really feel very passionately about. And Democrats really need to get this message, because this is something that makes people very, very angry after a little while.
Colin, a thought maybe about Ava Bermudez-Zimmerman, but also about the other potential insurgencies that we saw last night. A couple of them actually cropped up in the state legislative races that we were watching most closely. We saw at least one long time state legislator getting knocked off by someone who ran not necessarily to his left, but with a slightly different resume. And I think we're still up in the air with longtime Hartford political powerhouse Minnie Gonzalez and whether or not she's going to be voted out by someone challenging her.
Paz, are we still up in the air? I thought Minnie.
I would be stunned if Minnie. Does not get that.
Yeah, but it may not be official.
I think we would all be stunned, yeah. but as of this morning, it's still.
Yeah, but in part because I don't know. I was focused on governor, but I was getting messages from somebody in Hartford who was saying, "What the hell is going on there?" I'm guessing it was more about how fast things were recorded.
Absentee ballots may have been a big factor. Many tend to collect a lot of them. Let's go back to what you were talking about.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just to go back to Eva for just a second here, I think she's a little bit different from Johanna Hayes. First of all, she's running for a very different kind of office. She has with her, you know, a lot of youthful enthusiasm. There are a lot of people in the party who don't feel as though they identify with anybody else on the ticket. But wow, she's closer to my age. She looks a little bit more like me. She's, you know, but she's also a union organizer. Ned Lamont may not have been looking forward to running for governor with her at his side. There's a lot of unhappiness out in the electorate about public sector unions. I'm not sure that she was Ned's idea of an ideal running mate. There's no question that they need different kinds of faces, different kinds of age groups on that ticket than what they have. They're taking a huge risk right now running with old-fashioned Democrats as usual. William Tong is obviously ethnically different, but it's an A-line ticket. It's all the endorsed candidates, and you know it's not going to set anybody's emotions on fire. On the other hand, I'm not sure Bermuda Zimmerman was exactly the right way to solve that problem. But one of the questions I have is, yeah, she got 40%. Now, what do those people do? Some of them, I can guarantee you, are going to go, oh, okay, screw it. I got no use for these people. I'm not voting. They're going to walk away. And bringing as many of those people back to the table is one of the party's and Ned's job. You know, in terms of these down ticket elections, I mean, these legislative races, you know, they're often very, very local and very, very personal. In the case of Andy Fleischman, to whom you were alluding, he and Jillian Gilchrist, I swear to God, you couldn't slide a credit card between their policy differences. You know, I mean, they're just basically policy-wise the same person. She ran as a woman in maybe kind of a year of the woman. She also ran as a younger candidate. And, you know, Andy, I really like Andy a lot. He's been my state representative. I like him a lot, but, you know, you're in there for 12 terms and maybe you get a little complacent. Maybe the constituents feel you're a little out of touch. They haven't seen you
for
a while.
Well, I heard from at least one person yesterday that Jillian Gilchrist showed up at the house three different times. Andy right. Fleischman showed up yesterday.
Yeah. No, and she ran very hard and she networked. You know, these are small ball races. You can, if you put together a network of people, friends of friends of friends who will like talk you up and say, yeah, she's great and it's about time for her. You know, you win with just hundreds of votes in these things. And I mean, this did come down to a couple hundred votes, I think. So, yeah.
And the other thing about that is she is an example of why if you're willing to barge in, you can win. If she wait, because, you know, Andy was saying, well, I probably was only going to do one more term. Well, if she had waited till it was an open seat, she probably wouldn't have won the nomination. She would have had competition with people who were ahead of her in line. But by willing to sort of come in as the outsider and say, hey, it's time for a woman to hold this seat. I was involved with the march. I was involved with these issues. That's how you get to jump into politics at time, to have the ability and the willingness to upset people.
Yeah, and barging in is sometimes the only way to win. And we've seen some of that, certainly nationally, but a little bit in Connecticut as well, Susan.
Yeah, we have. Back to Bermuda Zimmerman, who tried to barge in. She was sort of a last-minute kind of a sensation for the convention. As soon as Bicewicz became the sort of de facto lieutenant governor endorsed candidate, as soon as Ned Lamont kind of picked her, this is when Eva Bruna Zimmerman became interesting to a lot of people. And so I think that this means that for next time, that insurgent candidates are great, but they don't win a lot. I think that next time, I think that these people who are in the Democratic Party, who are interested in diversity and who are interested in younger candidates, I think they're going to get a little bit better organized and get things going earlier.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, there's a lot more to talk about, including the results of a very interesting race in Vermont last night. Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributor to ctnewsjunkie.com. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with our friends Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and also Susan Bigelow, a contributor to ctnewsjunkie.com. I want to turn to you, Susan, and get a take from everybody in the room about a really interesting thing that happened in Vermont last night. It was the lead news item on NPR all throughout this morning. Christine Hallquist became the first openly transgender candidate in U.S. history to win a major party gubernatorial nomination, going up against Phil Scott in November. Some folks in Washington say, well, she has a chance in very, very blue Vermont. Phil Scott is a very, very popular governor who hasn't been in the seat for a very long time. And I think that he got voted in Vermont for some reasons having to do with them wanting a Republican there. But Christine Hallquist even getting a shot is something really, really remarkable.
It is. It's really special. I'm so proud of her. This is great. You know, for trans people like me, it's something that is. You didn't think it was going to be possible that a major party would nominate a transgender woman for governor ever, or at least not for many, many, many years to come. So it's a great sign of progress. I think it's also a reaction against a lot of the anti-trans policies of the Trump administration. But it shows that, yeah, this can be done, and it shows that we're not going away. We're still here, and it's a big moment. But can she win? I don't think so. I think that you know, the governor is very popular, and he's going to have to, like, I don't know, do something really despicable.
I have to ask you, though, about, you know, painting with a broad brush. Whenever we see some sort of a movement or change, somebody elected to something or getting a nomination for the very first time, it's easy, I think, for us to say this is part of a movement. This is part of something that is a reaction to Trump administration policies. Is this about a person in a place who is running at a time? Or, Susan, do you think this really does say something different about how America is just changing over the course of time?
I think it's both. I think it's also, if we want to talk about the change, I think it's indicative of change among certain people in certain places. Change among Democrats, liberal Democrats especially. She is part of a pattern of trans candidates winning. And this is something that has been a thing for the past couple of years, where we have trans candidates winning in Virginia, you know, and a couple of others all throughout the country. There's a few. I think that this is a pattern, and I think it is, at least in part, a reaction to the Trump administration's policies, which were themselves a reaction to kind of, I don't know, I hesitate to call it like a coming out, but a sort of more focused media lens on trans and transgender issues that happened about, you know, between 2012, 2013. So I think it's both. I think it is also, every race is going to be local in some way, but I think that these two things do come together.
Colin?
I think as you see millennial voters come aboard, play a bigger role in their parties and the generation following them, all this stuff is going to change very, very fast. For younger voters, this is not even that exotic a topic. This is somebody they knew in college. This is somebody that they hang out with now, just in the sense that, I mean, you know, I used to talk about gay marriage on WTIC in the late 90s and early aughts, and people would act like, well, I was crazy. What are you talking about? Letting gay people marry one another? Well, then by 2008, it was a settled question here in the state of Connecticut. I think these things happen. I mean, I think Kevin Limbo would be a hard thing to imagine in the 1990s as the comptroller of Connecticut, a gay man. But now it's like nothing. It just doesn't even register. And I think you're going to see that too. This generation that's coming aboard, I would add people like Eva Bermudez-Zimmerman. I think one of the things that younger people the way that they think of Latino and black people is they were my roommates in college. I might marry somebody like that someday. They're not this exotic group of people who live in cities and you never see them, you know, and that's why they expect to see people, you know, women of color, you know, gay people, trans people. They expect to see those people on tickets in a way that, say, my generation never did.
And I guess I'm just wondering, Paz, you'd mentioned this earlier, you know, Tim Herbst, a young millennial candidate who we thought had a chance in this gubernatorial race. He picks up the endorsements from a family institute, from people who are talking about some of these social conservative issues, bring back the death penalty, a lot of the stuff that candidates like the ones we were just talking about repudiate. And he doesn't get any traction whatsoever. Does it say anything at all to you about these issues on the Republican side as well?
Well, if you can't capitalize on those issues with a slender slice of the electorate, because that's all you needed to win the Republican primary, I think that does say something. I think that will be a lesson that people will take away in Connecticut, that those issues don't work. And in defense of Herbst, he was very careful as to what part of the Family Institute agenda he signed on to. It was a very limited part. It had to do with parental consent and parental notification of abortion by a minor. But yet, when you accept somebody's endorsement, you know, it's hard to parse things that clearly that, you know, you're either in, you're out. And that tends to be how those things work. I think the victory of Christine Hultquist in Vermont may be more important culturally than politically. And what I mean by that is there will be stories about what does it really mean to be trans, because I think there's still a lot of prejudice and misunderstanding about what it is in a way that the gay with people who are gay, that went away a while ago. But I also remember as somebody who is a young reporter who covered the gay rights movement in Connecticut, you know, I remember when people would testify at public hearings in behalf of anti-discrimination laws. And it would be like a moment because somebody was getting up before a microphone and they were gay. I mean, that sounds ridiculous to say today. And my kids would look at me like, what are you, nuts? But it was a thing because people were not out. And that was one of the lessons of the gay movement. You cannot demand rights unless you're out. So to have a trans candidate who has won the nomination of a major party in a gubernatorial race, that will have many impacts, I think.
A quick thought, Susan?
Yeah, I actually don't think that we can separate culture and politics anymore. I don't think that is possible. Also, Republicans really did miss an opportunity, I feel, with Aaron Stewart, another millennial candidate. I honestly don't think that the Republican primary electorate is particularly millennial at this point. They are not necessarily a young bunch. So Democrats are doing a lot better among young folks, and they're the future.
I've got to read now the Donald Trump tweet of the morning, and it goes like this. It's about time that Connecticut had a real and talented governor. Bob Stefanowski is the person needed to do the job. Tough on crime. Bob is also a big cutter of capital T taxes. He will win in November and make a great governor, a major difference maker. Bob has my total capital E endorsement. So he's getting the endorsement from the president of the United States, Colin.
Yeah, not particularly surprising. And I do see in Stefanowski some of the elements, not all of them, some of the elements of the Trump style of campaigning. You know, last time Danny Haar was in here, he was showing this picture he snapped in one of the debates where Stefanowski had gotten to his feet and was standing over David Stemmerman, pointing at him really angrily. And I was sort of thinking of Trump stalking Hillary Clinton around the stage in that famous debate. I think you'll see in a little bit of the – Stefanowski will have a little bit of the strut of Trump. He's not going to be Trump, but he'll have a little bit of that style, more so than probably any of those other candidates could have achieved.
He's a thoroughly corporate guy. He's not a pirate like Trump. And as far as the anger thing, I've had conversations with him after some pretty tough stories, including a phone call I got from him at 6:30 one morning because his campaign had totally screwed up their finance report. And I had a story out that made them look really bad. And the thing I'll say for him is he has reacted to those things very calmly. You know, I had a story after he walked away from a press conference without answering a question, and which was an
kind of Trumpy.
Yes, which was an invitation to be mocked. And I accepted the invitation. And when I saw him 2 days later, he walked over and very pleasantly said, you know, you killed me in that story. And I just said, well, I had a lot of help. And he laughed and he said, yeah, it wasn't my best moment. So I thought, you know, okay, this is not a guy who, like Trump, will go off the handle. I mean, there's a method to the madness with him.
Did you have a quick thought, Susan?
What a nice gift that was to Ned Lamont, President Trump's tweet. That was really nice of him.
Susan Bigelow contributes to CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks so much, Susan.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Mark Pazniokas.
Always
Pazniokas,
a pleasure.
Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Hard to say your name, Paz. Thanks so much for being here. And thanks also to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. Thank you so much, Colin.
Happy birthday yesterday, John. Now go start your vacation.
I'm going to start a vacation now. Thanks to the cameras of CTN. Thanks to Carlos Mejia for putting us on Facebook Live. Thanks to everyone who produces The Wheelhouse here on Connecticut Public Radio.